food, but now he was gone. God, his arrogance in keeping her here in his house. When is he going to kill me? I'm going mad. Going, gone. She peered through teary eyes into the pitch blackness. She'd been bound and gagged again. In a strange way, that was good news. It meant he still wanted her, right? Good God, I'm alive because I'm desirable to a horrid beast. Please help me, dear God. Please help me. She thought about her good girls, and then she turned her mind toward escape. A fantasy, she understood, and therefore escape in itself. By now, she knew this closet by heart, even in total darkness. It was as if she could see everything, as if she had night sight. More than anything, she was aware of her own body, trapped in here, and her mind trapped as well. Lizzie let her hands wander as much as they could. There were clothes in the closet, a male's, his. The closest to her was some kind of sports coat with round, smooth buttons, possibly a blazer. Lightweight, which reinforced her belief that this was a warm weather city. Next was a vest. A smallish ball was in one pocket, hard, maybe a golf ball. What could she do with a golf ball? Could it be a weapon? A zipper on the pocket. What could she do with a zipper? She'd like to catch his tattooed dick in it. Then a windbreaker, flimsy, strong, sickening smell of tobacco on it. And then, her favorite thing to touch, a soft overcoat, possibly cashmere. There were more treasures in the overcoat's pockets. A loose button, scraps of paper, from a notepad? A ballpoint pen, possibly a Bic. Coins, 4 quarters, 2 dimes, a nickel. Unless the coins were foreign, she wandered endlessly. There was also a book of matches, with a shiny cover and embossed letters. What did the embossed letters say? Could they tell her the city where she was being kept? Also a lighter. A half pack of mints, which she knew to be cinnamon because she smelled it on her hands. And at the bottom of the pocket, lint. So insignificant, yet important to her now. Behind the overcoat were 2 bundles of his clothing still covered in plastic from the cleaners. A receipt of some kind in the first packet, attached by a staple. She imagined the name of the cleaners, an identification number in red, writing by some dry cleaning store clerk. All of it seemed strangely precious to Lizzie because she had nothing else except a powerful will to live and get her revenge on the wolf.
Chapter 92.
I was a part of the large surveillance detail near the house in Highland Park, and I thought we were going to take Lawrence Lipton down soon. Maybe within hours. We'd been told that Washington was working with the Dallas police. I stared absently at the house, a large 2-story Tudor on about 2.5 acres of very expensive real estate. It looked pristine. A red brick sidewalk went from the street to an arched doorway which led to a 16-room house. The big news that day in Dallas was about a fire in Kessler Park that had incinerated a 64,000-square-foot mega-mansion. The Lipton spread was less than a third that size, but it was still impressive, or depressing, or both. It was around 9 in the evening. A supervisory agent from the Dallas office, Joseph Denyeau, came on my earphones. "We just got word from the director's office. We have to back off immediately. I don't understand it either. The order couldn't be any clearer, though. Pull back. Everybody head to the office. We need to reconnoiter and talk about this." I looked at my partner in the car that night, an agent named Bob Shaw. It was pretty obvious that he didn't understand what the hell had just happened either. "What was that?" I asked him. Shaw shook his head and rolled his eyes. "What do I know? We go back to the field office, drink some bad coffee. Maybe somebody higher up explains it to us, but don't count on it." It took us only 15 minutes to get to the field office at that time of night. We filed into a conference room at the field office, and I saw a lot of weary, confused, and pissed off agents. Nobody was saying much yet. We'd gotten close to a possible break on this case, and now we'd been ordered to pull back. Nobody seemed to understand why. The ASAC finally came out of his office and joined the rest of us. Joseph Denyeau looked thoroughly disgusted as he threw his dusty cowboy boots up on a conference table. "I have no idea," he announced. "Not a clue, folks. Consider yourselves debriefed." So about 40 agents waited for an explanation of the night's action, but one didn't come, or wasn't forthcoming, as they say. The agent in charge, Roger Nielsen, finally called D.C. and was told they would get back to us. In the meantime, we were to stand down. We might even be sent home in the morning. Around 11 o'clock, Denyeau got another update from Nielsen and passed it on to us. "They're working on it," he said, and smiled wryly.
"Working on what?" somebody called from the back.
"Oh, hell, I don't know, Donnie. Working on their pedicures. Working on getting all of us to quit the bureau. Then there'll be no more agents and I guess no more embarrassing screw-ups for the media to report. I'm going to get some sleep. I'd advise all of you to do the same."
That's what we did.
Chapter 93.
We were back at the field office by 8 the next morning. Several of the agents looked a little messed up after the night off. First thing, Director Burns was on the line from Washington. I was pretty sure the director rarely, if ever, spoke to the troops like this. So why do it now? What was up? Agents around the room were looking at one another. Brows crinkled, eyebrows arched. No one could fathom why Burns was so involved. Maybe I could. I'd seen the restlessness in him, the dissatisfaction with the ways of the past, even if he couldn't effectively change them all at once. Burns had started as a street cop in Philadelphia and worked his way up to police commissioner. Maybe he could change things at the bureau.
"I wanted to explain what happened yesterday," he said over the speakerphone.
Every agent in the room listened intently, myself included.
"And I also wanted to apologize to all of you. Everything got territorial for a while. The Dallas police, the mayor, even the governor of Texas was involved. The Dallas police asked that we pull back because they didn't have full confidence in us. I agreed to the action because I wanted to talk it through with them rather than force our presence there. They didn't want mistakes and they weren't sure that we have the right man. The Lipton family has a good reputation in the city. He's very well connected. Anyway, Dallas was surprised that we listened to their concerns, and now they've backed off again. They respect the team we've assembled. We will continue our action against Lawrence Lipton, and believe me, we're going to take that bastard down. Then we're going to take Pasha Sorokin down, the wolf. I don't want you to worry about past mistakes. Don't worry about mistakes at all. Just do your job in Dallas. I have the utmost confidence in you."
Burns went off the line, and just about every agent's face in the room wore a smile. It was quite magical, actually. The director had said things that some of them had been waiting years to hear. Especially welcome was the news that he believed in their ability and wasn't worried about mistakes. We were back in the game. We were expected to bring down Lawrence Lipton. Minutes after the phone call ended, my cell phone went off. I answered, and it was Burns himself.
"So how'd I do?" he asked.
I could hear the smile in his voice. I could almost see the cocky upturn of his lip when he grinned. He knew how he'd done. I walked away from the group into a far corner of the room and told him what he wanted to hear.
"You did good. They're pumped to do the job."
Burns exhaled.
"Alex, I want you to turn up the heat on this punk. I sold you hard to Dallas as a key member of the team. They bought you and your reputation. They know how good we think you are. I want you to make Lawrence Lipton very uncomfortable. Do it your own way."
I found myself smiling. "I'll see what I can do.
And Alex, contrary to what I said to the others, don't make any mistakes."
Chapter 94.
Don't make any mistakes. It was a hell of an exit line. I had to give him that. Kind of funny, in a sadistic, hard-ass way. I was starting to like Ron Burns again. Couldn't help myself. But did I trust him? Somehow, I got the feeling that Burns wasn't that worried about the mistakes, though. He wanted to catch the kidnappers, especially Pasha Sorokin, even if we didn't know yet who he really was or where he lived. According to Burns's orders, all I had to do was figure out a way to break Lawrence Lipton down, do it in a hurry, and not embarrass the Bureau in any way. I met with Roger Nielsen on possible strategies. We had already resumed surveillance on Lipton. It was decided that it was time to put real pressure on him, to let him know we were in Dallas and that we knew about him. After Burns's phone call, I wasn't surprised that I had been chosen to confront Lipton. We decided that I would go and see Lipton at his office in the Lakeside Square building at the intersection of the LBJ Freeway and the North Central Expressway. The building was 20 stories high, with lots of reflective glass. It was practically blinding as I looked skyward in the Texas sunshine. I walked inside at a little past 10 in the morning. Lipton's office suite was on the 19th floor. When I got off the elevator, a recorded voice said, "Howdy." I stepped into a large reception area with half an acre of wine-colored carpeting, beige walls, and dark brown leather sofas and chairs everywhere. They were framed, signed photos of Roger Staubach, Nolan Ryan, and Tom Landry on the walls. I was told to wait in reception by a very proper-looking young woman in a dark blue pantsuit. She sat self-importantly behind a sleek walnut desk under recessed lighting. She looked all of 22 or 23 years old, fresh out of charm school. She acted and spoke as properly as she looked. "I'll wait, but let Mr. Lipton know it's the FBI. It's important that I see him," I told her. The receptionist smiled sweetly as if she'd heard all this before. Then she went back to answering the phone calls coming in on her headset. I sat down and waited patiently. I waited for 15 minutes. Then I got back up again. I strolled over to the reception desk. "You told Mr. Lipton that I'm here?" I asked politely. "That I'm with the FBI?"
"I did, sir," she said in a syrupy voice that was starting to rub me the wrong way.
"I need to see him right now," I told the girl, and waited until she made another call to Lipton's assistant. They talked briefly, then she looked back at me.
"Do you have identification, sir?" she asked.
She was frowning now. "I do. They're called creds."
"May I see it, please? Your creds?"
I showed off my new FBI badge, and she looked it over like a fast food counter person inspecting a $50 bill.
"Could you please wait over at the seating area?"
she asked again. Only now she seemed a little nervous, and I wondered what Lawrence Lipton's assistant had told her, what her marching orders were. "You don't seem to understand, or I'm not making myself clear," I finally said. "I'm not here to fool around with you, and I'm not here to wait." The receptionist nodded.
"Mr. Lipton is in a meeting. That's all I know, sir."
I nodded back. "Tell his assistant to pull him out of his meeting right now. Have her tell Mr. Lipton that I'm not here to arrest him yet." I wandered back to the seating area, but I didn't bother to sit. I stood there and looked out on the magnificent technicolor green lawns that stretched to the concrete edge of the LBJ Freeway. I was burning inside. I'd just acted like a DC street cop. I wondered if Burns would have approved, but it didn't matter. He'd given me some rope, but I also made a decision that I wasn't going to change because I was an FBI agent now. I was in Dallas to bring down a kidnapper. I was here to find out if Mrs. Elizabeth Connolly and others were alive and maybe being held somewhere as slaves. I was back on the job. I heard a door open behind me and I turned. A heavy-set man with graying hair was standing there, and he looked angry.
"I'm Lawrence Lipton. What the hell is this about?"
Chapter 95.
"What the hell is this about?"
Lipton repeated from the doorway in a loudmouth, big-shot way. He was speaking to me as if I were a door-to-door brush salesman.
I think you were told that I'm in an important meeting. What does the FBI want with me, and why can't it wait? Why don't you have the courtesy to make an appointment?
There was something about his attitude that didn't completely track for me. He was trying to be a tough guy, but I didn't think he was. He was just used to beating up on other businessmen. He wore a rumpled blue dress shirt and a rep's tie, pinstriped trousers and tasseled loafers, and he was at least 50 pounds overweight. What could this man have in common with the wolf? I looked at him and said, "It's about kidnapping. It's about murder. Do you want to talk about this out here in reception? Sterling." Lawrence Lipton paled and lost most of his bravado.
"Come inside,"
he said, and took a step back. I followed him into an area of cubicles separated by low partitions. Clerical personnel, lots of them. So far, this was going about as I'd expected. But now it would get more interesting. Lipton might be softer than I had expected, but he had powerful connections in Dallas. This office building was in one of the most upscale residential commercial parts of the city. "I'm Mr. Potter," I said, as we walked down a corridor with fabric-covered walls. "At least I played Mr. Potter the last time we talked in the wolf's den." Lipton didn't turn, didn't respond in any way. We entered a wood-paneled office, and he shut the door. The large room had half a dozen windows and a panoramic view. A hat rack near the door held a collection of autographed Dallas Cowboy and Texas Ranger caps.
"I still don't know what this is about, but I'll give you exactly 5 minutes to explain yourself. I don't think you know who you're talking to."
"Actually, I do. You're Henry Lipton's oldest son. You're married with 3 children and a nice house in Highland Park. You're also involved with a kidnapping and murder scheme that we've been tracking closely for several weeks. You're Sterling, and I want you to understand something. All your connections, all your father's connections in Dallas will not help you now. On the other hand, I would like to protect your family as much as possible. That's up to you. I'm not bluffing. I don't ever bluff. This is a federal crime, not a local one."
"I'm going to call my lawyer,"
Lawrence Lipton said and went for the phone. "You have that right, but I wouldn't if I were you. It won't do any good." My tone of voice, something, stopped Lipton from making the call. His flabby hand moved away from the phone on his desk.
"Why?"
I said, "I don't care about you. You're involved in murder. But I've seen your kids, your wife. We've been watching you at the house. We've already spoken to your neighbors and friends. When you're arrested, your family will be in danger. We can protect them from the wolf." Lipton's face and neck reddened, and he erupted with,
"What the hell is wrong with you? Are you crazy? I'm a respected businessman. I never kidnapped or harmed another human being in my life. This is crazy."
"You gave the orders. The money came to you. Mr. Potter sent you $125,000. Or rather, the FBI did."
"I'm calling my lawyer. This is ridiculous and insulting. I don't have to take this from anybody."
I shrugged. "Then you're going down in the worst possible way. These offices will be searched immediately, and then your home in Highland Park. Your parents' home in Kessler Park will be searched. Your father's office will be searched. Your wife's offices at the Museum of Art will be searched." He picked up his phone. I could see that his hand was shaking, though. Then he whispered,
"Go fuck yourself."
I pulled out a two-way and spoke into it. "Hit the offices and the houses," I said. I turned back to Lipton. "You're under arrest. You can call your lawyer now. Tell him you've been taken to the FBI offices." Minutes later, a dozen agents stormed into the office with its gorgeous city views and stylish and expensive furnishings. We arrested Sterling.
Chapter 96.
Pasha Sorokin was close by, and he was watching everyone and everything with great interest. Maybe it was time to show the FBI how these things were done in Moscow, to show them that this wasn't a child's game to be played with rules made up by the police. He had been there outside Sterling's office building in Dallas when the FBI team rushed inside. More than a dozen of them came calling. A strange assemblage, to be sure. Some dressed in dark business suits, others in dark blue windbreakers with FBI boldly imprinted on the back. Who did they really expect to find here? The wolf? Others from the wolf's den? They had no concept of what they were getting themselves into. Their dark sedans and vans were parked in plain view on the street. Less than 15 minutes after they had entered the office building, they came out with Lawrence Lipton in handcuffs, pathetically trying to shield his face. What a scene. They wanted to make a show of this, didn't they? Why do that, he wondered. To prove how tough they were? How smart? But they weren't smart. I will show you how tough and smart you need to be. I will show you how lacking you are in every way. He instructed his driver to start the car. The wheelman did not look around at his boss in the back seat. He said nothing. He knew not to question orders. The wolf's ways were strange and unorthodox, but they worked. Drive past them, he ordered. I want to say hello. The FBI agents were casting nervous looks around the street as they led Lawrence Lipton toward a waiting van. A black man walked beside Sterling, tall and strangely confident. Pasha Sorokin knew from his informant in the bureau that this was Alex Cross, and that he was held in high regard. How was it possible that a black man was given command of the raid, he wondered. In Russia, the American Negro was looked down upon. Sorokin had never gotten past his own prejudice. There was no reason to in the U.S. Get me close, he told the driver. He lowered the rear passenger side window. The second Cross and Lipton had passed his car, Sorokin thrust out an automatic weapon and aimed it at the back of Sterling's head. Then an amazing thing, something he hadn't anticipated, happened. Alex Cross threw Lipton down onto the pavement, and they both rolled behind a parked car. How had Cross known? What had he seen to alert him? Sorokin fired anyway, but he didn't really have a clear shot. Still, the gunshot rang out loudly. He had delivered a message. Sterling wasn't safe. Sterling was a dead man.
Chapter 97.
We transported Lawrence Lipton to the Dallas field office and held him there. I threatened to transfer him to Washington if there was any interference from the local police or even the press. I struck a deal with them. I promised Dallas detectives they'd have their turn with Lipton, as soon as I was done. At 11 o'clock that night, I slumped into a windowless interview room. It was sterile and claustrophobic, and I felt as if I'd been there a couple hundred times before. I nodded to Lawrence Lipton. He didn't respond. He looked just awful. Probably I did, too. We can help you, your family. We'll keep them safe. Nobody else can help you now, I said. That's the truth. Lipton finally spoke to me.
I don't want to talk to you again. I already told you I'm not involved in any of this shit you say I am. I'm not going to talk anymore. Get my lawyer.
He waved me away. For the past 7 hours, he'd been questioned by other FBI agents. This was my third session, and it wasn't getting easier. His lawyers were in the building, but they'd backed off. They had been informed that he could be formally charged with kidnapping and conspiracy to commit murder, and immediately transported to Washington. His father was also in the building, but had been denied access to his son. I'd interviewed Henry Lipton, and he had wept and insisted his son's arrest was a mistake. I sat down across from Lawrence. Your father's in the building. Would you like to see him? I asked. He laughed.
Yeah, sure. All I have to do is admit that I'm a kidnapper and a murderer. Then I can see my father and ask his forgiveness for my sins.
I ignored the sarcasm. He wasn't very good at it. You know, we can confiscate the records of your father's company. Shut it down. Also, your father is a likely target for the wolf. We're not here to hurt your family members, I added. Not unless your father is involved in this, too. He shook his head, kept his eyes lowered.
My father has never been in trouble.
That's what I keep hearing, I said. I've read a lot about you and your family in the past day or so. Gone all the way back to your school days at Texas. You were involved in a couple of scrapes in Austin. 2 date rapes. Neither case went to trial. Your father saved you then. It won't happen this time. Lawrence Lipton didn't respond. His eyes were dead, and he looked as if he hadn't slept in days. His blue dress shirt was as wrinkled as a used tissue, soaked with perspiration at the underarms. His hair was wet, dripping little rivers of moisture down to his shirt collar and sideburns. The skin under his eyes sagged and had a purplish tint in the harsh interrogation room light. He finally said,
I don't want my family hurt. You leave my father out of this. Get him protection.
I nodded. Okay, Lawrence. Where do we start? I'm ready to put your family in protective custody until we catch him.
And afterward? It doesn't stop with him.
We'll protect your family. Lipton sighed loudly, then said,
All right. I'm the money man. I'm Sterling. I might be able to get you to the wolf, but I need promises in writing. Lots of promises.
Chapter 98.
I was heading into the deepest darkness again. Attached to it as most people are attached to sunlight. I kept thinking about Elizabeth Connolly, still missing and feared dead. Lipton's father visited him a couple of times and the two men wept together. Mrs. Lipton was allowed to see her husband. There was a lot of crying among the family members, and most of the emotions seemed genuine. I was in the interrogation room with Sterling until a little past 3 in the morning. I was prepared to stay later, as long as it took to get the information I needed. Several deals were struck with his lawyers during the night. At around 2, with most of the lawyering done, Lipton and I sat down to talk again. 2 senior agents from the Dallas field office were in the room with us. They were only there to take notes and tape record. This was my interview to conduct. How did you get involved with the wolf? I asked Lawrence Lipton, after a few minutes during which I emphasized my concern for his family. He seemed clearer-headed and more focused than he'd been a few hours before. I sensed that a weight had been lifted from him. Guilt, betrayal of his family, especially his father. His school records revealed he was a bright but troubled student. His problems always centered on an obsession with sex, but he'd never received a day of treatment. Lawrence Lipton was a freak.
How did I get involved?
He repeated, seeming to be asking the question of himself.
I have a thing for young girls, you see. Teens, preteens. There's lots of it available these days. The internet opened new sources.
For what? Be as concrete as you can, Lawrence. He shrugged.
For freaks like myself. Nowadays we can get what we want when we want it, and I know how to search for the nastiest sites. At first, I settled for photos and movies. I especially liked real-time films.
We found some. In your office at home.
And one day a man came to see me. He came to the office just like you did.
To blackmail you? Lipton shook his head.
No, not blackmail. He said he wanted to know what I really wanted. Sexually. And he would help me to get it. I threw him out. He came back the next day. He had records of everything I'd bought on the internet. So what do you really want? He asked again. I wanted young girls, pretty ones, with no strings attached, no rules. He supplied me with 2 or 3 a month, exactly what I fantasized. Color of hair, shape of breasts, shoe size, freckles, anything I desired.
What happened to the girls? Did you murder them? You have to tell me.
I'm not a killer. I like to see the girls get off. Some did. We'd party, then they'd be released. Always. They didn't know who I was or where I was from.
So you were satisfied with the arrangement?
Lipton nodded and his eyes lit up.
Very. I've been dreaming of this my whole life. The reality was as good as the fantasy. Of course, there was a price.
A bill had to be paid?
Oh, yeah. I got to meet the wolf. At least I think it was him. He had sent an emissary to my office in the early days, but then he came to see me. In person, he was very scary. Red Mafia, he said. The KGB came up, but I don't know what his connection to them was.
What did he want from you?
To go into business with him, to be a partner. He needed my company's expertise with computers and the internet. The sex club was secondary with him, a throw-in. He was heavily into extortion, money laundering, counterfeiting. The club was my thing. Once our deal was struck, I went looking for wealthy freaks who wanted their dreams fulfilled. Freaks who were willing to spend six figures for a slave, male, female, didn't matter. Sometimes a specific target, sometimes a physical type.
To murder? I asked Lipton.
Whatever they wanted. Let me tell you where I think he was going with the club. He wanted to involve very rich, powerful men. We already had one, a senator from West Virginia. He had big plans.
Does the wolf live in Dallas? I finally asked. You've got to help me if you want my help. Lipton shook his head.
He isn't from around here. He doesn't live in Dallas, not in Texas. He's a mystery man.
But you know where he is. He hesitated, but finally went on.
He doesn't know that I know. He's smart, but not about computers. I tracked him once. He was sure his messages were secure, but I had them cracked. I needed to have something on him.
Then Sterling told me where he thought I could find the wolf, and also who he was. If I could believe what he was saying, Sterling knew the name Pasha Sorokin was using in the United States. It was Ari Manning.
Chapter 99.
I sat high in the cockpit of a luxury cabin cruiser in the intercoastal waterway near Millionaire's Row in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Were we close to the wolf now? I needed to believe that we were. Sterling swore to it, and he had no reason to lie to us. Did he? He had every reason to tell the truth. Sightseers came here on motorboat tours, so I figured we wouldn't be noticed right away. Besides, darkness was starting to fall. We drove past mansions that were mostly Mediterranean or Portuguese style, but an occasional Georgian colonial supposedly signaled northern money. We'd been warned to tread lightly, not to ruffle feathers in this wealthy neighborhood, which, frankly, wouldn't be possible. We were going to ruffle a lot of feathers in a few minutes. On board the cruiser with me were Ned Mahoney and two of his seven-person assault teams. Mahoney didn't ordinarily go on missions himself, but since Baltimore, the director had been changing that. The FBI had to get stronger in the field. I watched a large waterfront house through binoculars as our boat approached a dock. Several expensive yachts and speedboats bobbed in the water nearby. We had secured a floor plan of the house and learned it had been purchased for $24 million 2 years ago. Don't ruffle any feathers. A large party was in progress at the estate, which belonged to Ari Manning. According to Sterling, he was Pasha Sorokin, the wolf.
Looks like everybody's having a fine old time, Mahoney said from the deck. Man, I love a good party. Food, music, dancing, bubbly.
Yeah, it's jumping. And the surprise guests haven't even shown up, I said. Ari Manning was known around Fort Lauderdale in Miami for the parties he hosted, sometimes a couple a week. His extravaganzas were famous for their surprises, surprise guests, like the coaches of the Miami Dolphins and the Miami Heat, hot musical and comedy acts from Las Vegas, politicians and diplomats and ambassadors, even right up to the White House.
Guess we're tonight's surprise special guests, Mahoney said, and grinned at me.
Flown in all the way from Dallas, I said. with our entourage of 14. The guests, the nature of the glitzy party itself, made the operation tense, which was probably why Mahoney and I felt compelled to make a few jokes. We'd talked about waiting, but HRT wanted to go in now, while we knew the wolf was there. The director agreed and had actually made the final decision. A guy in a ridiculous sailor suit was vigorously waving us away from the dock. We kept coming. "What's this asshole on the dock want?" Mahoney asked me. "We're full up! You're too late!" the man on the dock shouted to us. His voice carried above the music blasting from the back part of the mansion. "Party doesn't start without us," Ned Mahoney called back. Then he tooted the horn. "No, no, don't come in here," Sailor Suit yelled. "Get away!" Mahoney tooted the horn again. The cruiser bumped a Bertram speeder, and the guy on the dock looked as if he were going to have a stroke.
"Jesus, be careful! This is a private party. You can't just come in here. Are you friends of Mr. Manning?"
Mahoney tooted again.
"Absolutely. Here's my invitation."
He pulled out his ID and his gun. I was already off the boat and running toward the house.
Chapter 100.
I pushed my way through the crowd of very well-heeled partygoers making their way to candlelit tables. Dinner was being served now. Steak and lobsters, lots of champagne, and pricey wine. Everybody seemed to have worn their Dolce & Gabbana, their Versace, their Yves Saint Laurent couture. I had on faded jeans and a blue FBI windbreaker. Coiffed heads turned and eyes flashed at me as if I were a party crasher. I was. The party crasher from hell. These people had no idea. "FBI," Mahoney called from behind as he led his heavily armed teams into the crowd. I knew from Sterling what Pasha Sorokin looked like, and I headed his way. He was right there. The wolf had on an expensive gray suit, a blue cashmere t-shirt. He was talking to two men near a billowing blue and yellow striped canopy where the grills were working. Enormous cuts of meat and fish were being prepared by smiling, sweaty chefs, all of them black or Hispanic. I pulled out my Glock and Pasha Sorokin stared at me without moving a muscle. He just stared. Didn't make a move, didn't try to run. Then he smiled as if he'd been expecting me and was glad I'd finally arrived. What was with this guy? I saw him flash a hand signal to a white-haired man whose arm was draped around a curvy blonde less than half his age.
"Atticus!"
Sorokin called, and the man scurried over faster than kitchen help.
"I'm Atticus Stonestrom, Mr. Manning's lawyer. You have absolutely no reason to be here, to barge into Mr. Manning's house like this. You're completely out of line, and I'm asking you to leave."
"Not going to happen. Let's move this private party inside. Just the three of us," I said to Stonestrom and Sorokin. "Unless you want the arrest to take place in front of all these guests."
The wolf looked at his lawyer, then shrugged as if this were no big deal to him. He started to walk toward the house. Then he turned, pretending he'd just remembered something.
"Your little boy's name. It's also Alex, isn't it?"
Chapter 101.
She wasn't dead. How good was that? How amazing. Elizabeth Connolly was lost in her own world again, and it was the best place. She was walking a perfect beach on Oahu's north shore. She was picking up the most amazing seashells, one after the other, comparing the textures. Then she heard shouts. "FBI!" She couldn't believe it. The FBI was here? At the house? Her heart pounded, then nearly stopped, then pounded again, even harder. Had they finally come to rescue her? Why else would they be here? Oh, my good God! Lizzie began to shake all over. Tears spilled down her cheeks. They had to find her and let her out now. The wolf's arrogance was about to burn him down. "I'm in here! I'm here! I'm right here!" The party got terribly quiet suddenly. Everyone was whispering, and it was hard to hear. but she definitely heard FBI and theories as to why they were here. Drugs. Everyone seemed to think so. Lizzie prayed this wasn't about drugs. What if they took the wolf to jail? She would be left here. She couldn't stop shaking. She had to let the FBI know she was here. But how? She was always bound and gagged. They were so close. I'm in the closet. Please, look in the closet. She had imagined dozens of escape plans, but only after the wolf had opened the door and leashed her to go to the bathroom or walk in the main part of the house. Lizzie knew there was no way to get out of the locked closet, not tied up the way she was. She didn't know how to signal the FBI. Then she heard someone making a loud announcement. A male, deep voice, calm and in control. I'm Agent Mahoney, with the FBI. Everyone leave the main house immediately. Please assemble on the back lawns. Everyone is to leave the house now. No one leaves the grounds. Lizzie heard shoes scraping the hardwood floors, rapid footsteps. People were leaving? Then what? She'd be all alone. If they took the wolf away, what would happen to her? There had to be something she could do to let the FBI know she was in here. What? Someone named Atticus Stonestrom was talking loudly. Then she heard the wolf speak, and it chilled her. He was still in the house, arguing with someone. She couldn't tell who or exactly what they were saying. What can I do? Something. Anything. What? What? What haven't I thought of before? And then Lizzie had an idea. Actually, she'd had it before, but always dismissed it, because it scared the hell out of her.
Chapter 102.
I'm glad you're here to see this for yourself, Atticus. This is such bullshit harassment. My businesses are beyond reproach. You know that better than anyone. This is highly insulting.
He looked at me.
Do you know how many business associates you've insulted at this party?
I was still restraining myself from responding to his threat to my family, to little Alex. I didn't want to take him down. I wanted to take him out. Trust me, this isn't harassment, I told the lawyer. We're here to arrest your client for kidnapping. Sorokin rolled his eyes.
Are you people mad? Do you know who I am?
Jesus, I'd heard almost the same speech in Dallas. As a matter of fact, I do, I said. Your real name is Pasha Sorokin, not Ari Manning. Some people say you're the Russian godfather. You're the wolf. Sorokin heard me out, then he laughed a crazy laugh.
You are such fools, you especially.
He pointed at me.
You just don't get it.
Suddenly there were shouts coming from one of the other rooms on the first floor. Fire! Someone was yelling. Come on, Alex, Mahoney said. He and I left Sorokin with three other agents and ran to see what the hell was going on. How could there be a fire? Now? There was a fire. It seemed to have started in the large study off the main living room, in a closet. Swirls of smoke came from under the door. A lot of smoke. I grabbed the doorknob, which was hot. The closet was locked. I didn't hesitate. I lowered my shoulder and hit the door hard. I slammed into it again. The wood cracked this time. I hit it once more and the door collapsed. Thick black smoke billowed out. I stepped up close and tried to peer inside. Then I saw something move. Someone was in there. I could see a face. Elizabeth Connolly was in there. And she was on fire.
Chapter 103.
I took a breath, then lunged forward into the cloud of smoke and heat. I felt the skin on my face begin to burn. I forced myself inside the walk-in closet, stooped down. I grabbed Elizabeth Connolly in my arms and stumbled backward out of the closet with her. My eyes were tearing and my face felt blistered. Elizabeth's eyes were wide open as I removed her gag. Ned Mahoney worked on the rope bindings around her arms.
Thank you, she whispered in a voice hoarse with smoke. Oh, thank you, she gasped.
Tears ran from her eyes, smudging the soot on her cheeks. My heart thumped a wild beat as I held her hand and waited for the paramedics to come. I couldn't believe she was alive, but it made everything worthwhile. I only got to savor the feeling for a few seconds. Shots rang out. I ran from the den, turned the corner, and saw two agents down, but alive.
Bodyguard came in firing, the closest agent told me. He and Manning ran upstairs.
I hurried up the stairs with Ned Mahoney following close behind. Why would the wolf go upstairs? It didn't make sense to me. More agents joined us. We searched every room. Nothing. We couldn't find the wolf or the bodyguard. Why had they run upstairs?
Mahoney and I did another full walkthrough of all the rooms on the second and third floors. Fort Lauderdale police had begun to arrive and help secure the house.
I don't see how he got out of here, Mahoney said. We were huddled together in the second floor hallway, puzzled and disgusted.
Has to be a way out up here somewhere. Let's look again.
We retraced our steps down the second floor hallway, checking in several guest bedrooms. At the far end of the hall was another stairway, probably used by the help. We'd already searched it, sealed it off at the bottom. Then it struck me. A small detail I had overlooked. I hurried down to the first landing. There was a casement window and a window seat there. It was just as I'd remembered. Two small cushions on the floor. I opened the cover of the window seat. Ned Mahoney groaned out loud. He saw what I'd found. The escape route. The wolf had gotten out.
He might still be in here. Let's see where this goes, I said.
Then I lowered myself into the opening. There were narrow wooden stairs, a half dozen of them. Mahoney held a flashlight on me as I climbed down.
It's here, Ned,
I called back to him. I saw how they'd made it out. A window was open. I could see water a few feet below.
They went into the intercoastal, I called up to Mahoney. They're in the water.
Chapter 104.
I joined the frantic search in the waterway and the rest of the neighborhood, but it was already dark. Mahoney and I raced up and down narrow estate-lined streets. Then we drove along nearby Las Olas Boulevard, hoping that someone had spotted two men in soaking wet clothes. But no one had seen the wolf or his bodyguard. I wouldn't give up. I went back to the Isla Bahia Estates area. Something was wrong. Why hadn't anyone spotted two men fitting that description? I wondered if they had diving gear in the cellar alcove. How thoroughly had the wolf planned his escape? What precautions had he taken? Then I let my mind go in a different direction. He's arrogant and fearless. He didn't believe we'd find him and come here to take him down. He didn't have an escape route. So maybe he's still hiding in Isla Bahia. I passed my ideas on to HRT, but they'd already begun to go door to door at the estates. There were now dozens of agents and local police combing the exclusive neighborhood in Fort Lauderdale. I wouldn't give up, wouldn't let the others quit. Whatever drove me, perseverance, stubbornness, had paid off before. But we didn't find the wolf or anyone who'd seen him in Isla Bahia.
There's nothing? No sign? Nobody saw anything? I asked Mahoney.
Nothing, Mahoney said. We found a cocker spaniel on the loose. That's it.
We know who owns the dog? I asked.
Mahoney rolled his eyes. I didn't blame him.
I'll check.
He went away and came back after a couple of minutes. It belongs to a Mr. and Mrs. Steve Davis. The Davises live at the end of the street. We'll bring them their dog. Satisfied?
I shook my head.
Not really. Let's the two of us return the dog, I said. I don't know why a dog would be loose this late at night. Is the family home?
Doesn't look like it. The lights are off at the house.
Come on, Alex. Jesus, this is hopeless. You're clutching at straws. Pasha Sorokin is gone.
Let's go. Get the dog, I said.
We're going to the Davis house.
Chapter 105.
We had started toward the Davis house with the brown and white cocker spaniel when a report came over the two-way.
Two suspicious males heading toward Las Olas Boulevard. They've spotted us. We're in pursuit.
We were only a few blocks from the shopping district and got there in minutes. The cocker spaniel was barking in the back seat. Fort Lauderdale police patrol cars and FBI sedans had already formed a tight ring around a Gap clothing store. More patrol cars were arriving, their sirens screaming in the night. The street was crowded and the local police were having trouble stopping pedestrian flow. Mahoney drove up to the blockade. We left a window cracked for the dog. He and I jumped out and ran toward the Gap. We were wearing flak jackets, carrying handguns. The store lights were blazing. I could see people inside, but not the wolf, not the bodyguard either.
We think it's him, an agent told us when we got up close to the store.
How many gunmen inside? I asked.
We count two. Two that we know about. Could be more. There's a lot of confusion.
Yeah, no shit, said Mahoney. I get that impression. For the next few minutes, nothing useful happened, except that more Lauderdale patrol cars arrived on the scene. So did a heavily armed and armored SWAT unit. A hostage negotiator showed up. Then a pair of news helicopters began to hover over the Gap and surrounding stores.
Nobody's answering the goddamn phone inside, the negotiator reported. It just rings.
Mahoney looked questioningly at me, and I shrugged.
We don't even know if it's them inside.
The negotiator took up a bullhorn.
This is the Fort Lauderdale police. Come out of the store now. We're not going to negotiate. Come out with your hands up. Whoever's in there, get out now.
The approach sounded wrong to me. Too confrontational. I walked up to the negotiator. I'm FBI Agent Cross. Do we need to back him into a corner? He's violent. He's extremely dangerous. The negotiator was a stocky guy with a thick mustache. He was wearing a flak jacket, but it wasn't secured.
Get the fuck away from me, he shouted in my face. This is a federal case, I shouted right back.
I grabbed the bullhorn out of his hand. The negotiator went at me with his fists, but Mahoney wrestled him to the ground. The press was watching.
To hell with him. We had a job to do here.
This is the FBI, I said into the bullhorn. I want to talk to Pasha Sorokin. Then suddenly the strangest thing of the night happened, and it had been a very strange night. I almost couldn't believe it. Two men emerged from the front door of the Gap. They held their hands in front of their faces, shielding them from the cameras. Or maybe from us.
Get down on the ground, I shouted at them.
They didn't comply. But then I could see it. It was Sorokin and the bodyguard.
We're not armed,
Sorokin yelled, loudly enough for everybody to hear.
We're innocent citizens. We have no guns.
I didn't know whether to believe him. None of us knew what to make of this. The TV helicopter over our heads was getting too close.
What's he doing? Mahoney asked me.
Don't know.
Get down! I shouted again.
The wolf and the bodyguard continued to walk toward us, slowly and carefully. I moved ahead with Mahoney. We had our guns out. Was this a trick? What could they try with dozens of rifles and handguns aimed at them? The wolf smiled when he saw me. Why the hell was he smiling?
So you caught us. Big deal. It doesn't matter, you know. I have a surprise for you, FBI. Ready? My name is Pasha Sorokin, but I'm not the wolf.
He laughed.
I'm just some guy shopping in the Gap. My clothes got wet. I'm not the wolf, Mr. FBI. Is that funny?